Seize the Day by Saul Bellow, Viking Press, New York, New York, 1956. This is a psychological novel in the setting of New York City in the 1950s. Our principal characters include Wilhelm Adler, an emotionally ravaged young man, and Dr. Adler, Wilhelm's perfectionist father, Wilhelm's ex-wife, Margaret, and his present girlfriend, Olive. Emotional brutality had marked the 40-odd-year relationship between Wilhelm Adler and his father, Dr. Adler, the respected diagnostician. Fastidious in both dress and manners, Dr. Adler had a face marked by a wholesome reddish and almost translucent color like a ripe apricot. The wrinkles beside his ears were carved deep because the skin conformed so tightly to his bones. With all his might, he was a healthy and fine, small old man. The doctor had little tolerance for his son's slothful ways, and even long years after Wilhelm had reached adulthood, he treated him as if he were a spoiled, messy child. The fact that Dr. Adler insisted upon calling Wilhelm by his childhood nickname, Wilkie, typified the doctor's domination over his son. In fact, whenever he found himself trapped in his father's presence, Wilkie actually reverted to markedly childlike behavior, stammering and fidgeting uncontrollably. It was characteristic of Dr. Adler to judge a man on the size of his bank account. As a matter of pride, he often lied to friends about Wilhelm's earnings, pretending that his son, who had recently been laid off from his latest job with a toy manufacturer, was a successful businessman. Wilhelm's pleas to his father for financial relief, however, were met only with formulated homilies from the father's well-rehearsed litany. "There's a poor man with a bone condition which is gradually breaking him up. I've learned to keep my sympathy for the real ailments." That Wilhelm was also gradually breaking up, not from any physical disease, but from a progressive state of financial and spiritual decay, was a reality which Dr. Adler refused to apprehend. To him, only money and medicine, the two palpably useful commodities that he knew and respected, were real. Dr. Adler's only recommendation was that his son undertake hydrotherapy or muscle massage. And now, as Wilhelm confronted his father with a last desperate plea for money, the doctor's disgust erupted into an irrevocable dismissal. "Go away from me now. It's torture for me to look at you, you slob. You want to make yourself into my cross, but I am not going to pick up a cross. I'll see you dead, Wilkie, by Christ, before I let you do that to me." Wilhelm's estranged wife, Margaret, also had dismissed him from her conscience. She refused to give him the divorce he asked for, yet still insisted that he agree to support her and the two children, despite the fact that he was nearly bankrupt. In addition, she held him solely responsible for everything that had gone wrong with his life, for his unemployment, his sexual impotence, and their family breakup. When he begged for mercy, her reply was immediate and brutal. "How did you imagine it was going to be, Big Shot? Everything made smooth for you?" Margaret had even denied Wilhelm the companionship of the family dog. "4 years ago, when we broke up, I gave her everything, goods, furniture, savings," he remembered bitterly. "I tried to show goodwill, but I didn't get anywhere. Why, when I wanted scissors, she absolutely refused. Not that she cared a damn about the animal." Margaret's unyielding, unsympathetic spite had spilled over to contaminate Wilhelm's new attachments, too. After his separation, he had fallen madly in love with a girl named Olive, who promised to marry him once he was divorced. But Margaret would not let him go. Now his romance with Olive had begun to crumble. When she would get up late on Sunday morning, she would wake him almost in tears at being late for Mass. He would try to help her hitch her garters and smooth out her slip and dress, and even put on her hat with shaky hands. she got out a block from church to avoid gossip. Perhaps Wilhelm's pain had really begun as a teen with the death of his mother. He was, after all, his mother's son. It was from her that he had inherited sensitive feelings, a soft heart, a brooding nature, a tendency to be confused under pressure. The doctor's mistreatment of both his wife and son had also made them equal partners in sorrow. They shared the iron bonds of a mutually oppressed. "You were set free when Ma died," Wilhelm once accused his father. "You wanted to forget her." Though other authority figures in his life had generally ignored him, Wilhelm could recall that his mother had cared enough at least to attempt once to dissuade him from what she considered a foolish course of action. On the day he had announced his decision to become an actor, Dr. Adler, ashamed of his son, had literally turned his back on Wilhelm. "Mama was the one who tried to stop me," Wilhelm remembered, pondering the incident. "And we carried on and yelled and pleaded. Poor mother. How I disappointed her." Declining his mother's appeal that he go into medicine with his father, Wilhelm had moved to Hollywood anyway and taken on the name Tommy Wilhelm, dropping the searing Adler. And he had actually been hired a few times, though only as an extra. Dr. Adler had often tried to explain his son's new name. "I uphold tradition. He's for the new." But Tommy had left Hollywood when his agent finally shared with him the fact that he was wasting his time trying to be an actor. And since then, his forays into various business ventures had all somehow led into shadowy dead ends. Finally, desperate to earn his father's approval and to meet the support payments demanded by his wife, Wilhelm had invested his last $700 in lard futures. His investment partner, Dr. Tamkin, a self-proclaimed psychologist with a mesmerizing gift of persuasion, had promised him huge returns. "I am at my most efficient," Tamkin had boasted with customary exuberance, "when I don't need the fee, when I only love. The spiritual compensation is what I look for, bringing people into the real universe. That's the present moment. The past is no good to us. The future is full of anxiety. Only the present is real. The here and now. Seize the day." But Wilhelm's association with Dr. Tamkin had proved only one in a long line of disastrous attempts to find nurturance, to be loved and watched over by a sympathetic parent. Once again, he had placed his trust, not to mention his money and his fragile psyche, in the wrong hands. Tamkin had claimed that the whole secret to this type of speculation is in the alertness. You have to act fast, buy it and sell it and buy it again, get to the window and have them wire Chicago at just the right second. Yet, when the time came to sell, Tamkin had dawdled, and the golden moment was lost. And then, predictably, the wizard had disappeared, leaving his raving, almost lunatic disciple to search for him in the streets. What a creature Tamkin was when he took off his hat, Wilhelm now marveled in despair. The indirect light showed the many complexities of his bald skull, his gull's nose, the rather handsome eyebrows, his vain mustache, his deceiver's brown eyes. In the end, even God the Father had seemed to fail Wilhelm. His petitions to heaven all went unheard or ignored. "O God," he prayed, "let me out of my trouble. Let me out of my thoughts. For all the time I have wasted, I am very sorry. Let me out of this clutch and into a different life, for I am all balled up." But God did not release Wilhelm from his weighty burden of selfhood. No, the spirit, the peculiar burden of his existence, lay upon him like an accretion, a load, a hump. In any moment of quiet, when sheer fatigue prevented him from struggling, he was apt to feel this mysterious weight, this growth or collection of nameless things which it was the business of his life to carry about. Now, jobless and destitute, abandoned by every being whose love he had craved and solicited, Tommy Wilhelm Adler realized that his only hope for relief lay in death. Wandering randomly into the funeral service of a stranger, he gazed enviously down at the figure in the coffin. The dead man had two large waves of gray hair at the front, but he was not old. His face was long, and he had a bony nose, slightly, delicately twisted. His brows were raised as though he had sunk into the final thought. Now, at last, he was at the end of all distractions. And by his meditative look, Wilhelm was so struck that he could not go away. Then the funeral music started up, and Wilhelm's moment of epiphany swelled into being. The flowers and lights fused ecstatically in his blind, wet eyes. The heavy, sea-like music came to his ears. It poured into him, where he had hidden himself in the center of a crowd by the great and happy oblivion of tears. He heard it and sank deeper than sorrow, through torn sobs and cries, toward the consummation of his heart's ultimate need. Jolted out of his lonely, vulnerable trajectory into another, more peaceful orbit, he had experienced a catharsis, an annihilation of his faltering former self, and an acceptance of himself as a lone, free creature. In a single climactic moment of rebirth, Wilhelm Adler had at last come to terms with his own humanity. At once he found himself resurrected, strengthened, serene, intact, whole. Saul Bellow's Seize the Day chronicles one day in the life of Tommy Wilhelm Adler, a day which captures the whole agony of a man's descent into emotional and financial ruin. Though he is already well into middle age when we meet him, Wilhelm is still not free to accept responsibility for his life. Forever frozen into his early role as the family failure, he behaves as a helpless, forsaken child, flailing and howling as he slides down into hell. "I expect help," wails Wilhelm. But his cries are left unanswered. Help is not forthcoming. No kind, wise parent appears to rescue the doomed spiritual orphan. Release and help are at last attained only through his own symbolic death. As the book's introduction conveys, Wilhelm's search to affirm his own humanity not only moves the reader through deep pity, but arouses an identification with that search as expressive of what everyone who would come to terms with himself must undergo. At the same time, Bellow raises some probing questions for each of us. Just how much and what kinds of financial, emotional, or spiritual support do parents and children owe to one another? And to what extent does a man's monetary worth determine his inner value?